Up to now, Craig had needed only a pen and a pile of paper, and time had been his to squander, or use as the fancy led him. Suddenly he was faced with the enormous responsibility of ownership, and time telescoped in upon him. There was so much to do, and so little time to do it, that he felt crippled with indecision, appalled by his own audacity, and despairing of his own organisational skills. He wanted comfort and encouragement, and he thought immediately of Sally Ann. He drove around to her apartment, but the windows were closed, the mail overflowed her box, and there was no answer to his knock. He returned to the bedsitter, sat at his table and pulled a blank sheet from the pile and headed it, "Work to be done," and then stared at it. He remembered what a girl had once said of him. "You've only done one thing well in your life," and writing a book was a far cry from getting a multi-million dollar ranching company back on its feet. He felt panic rising within him and crushed it back. His was a ranching family. He had been raised with the ammoniacal smell of cow dung in his nostrils, and had learned to judge beef on the hoof when he was small enough to perch up on Bawoo's saddle pommel like a sparrow on a fence pole. "I can do it," he told himself fiercely, and began to work on his list. He wrote, 1. Ring Jock Daniels, accept offer to purchase Rowlands. 2. Fly to New York, A. World Bank meeting, B. Open checking account and deposit funds, C. Sell Bawoo. 3. Fly Zurich, A. Sign share purchase, B. Arrange payment to sellers. His panic began to subside. He picked up the telephone and dialed British Airways. They could get him out on the Friday flight to London and then Concorde to New York. He caught Jock Daniels in his office.
"Where the hell have you been?"
He could hear Jock had made a good start in the evening's drinking.
"Jock, congratulations. You've just made yourself 25 grand commission," Craig told him, and enjoyed the stunned silence.
Craig's list began to stretch out, ran into a dozen pages. 39. Find out if Ocky von Rensburg is still in the country. Ocky had been the mechanic on King's Lynn for 20 years. Craig's grandfather had boasted that Ocky could strip down a John Deere tractor and build up a Cadillac and 2 Rolls-Royce Silver Clouds from the spare parts. Craig needed him. He laid down his pen and smiled at his memory of the old man.
"We're coming home, Bawoo," he said aloud.
He looked at his watch, and it was 10 o'clock,
but he knew he would not be able to sleep.
He put on a light sweater and went out to walk the night streets, and an hour later he was standing outside Sally Ann's apartment. His feet had made their own way, it seemed. He felt a little tingle of excitement. Her window was open and her light burning.
"Who is it?"
Her voice was muffled.
"It's me, Craig."
There was a long silence.
"It's nearly midnight."
"It's only just 11 and I have something to tell you."
"Oh, okay. Door is unlocked."
She was in her darkroom. He could hear the splash of chemicals.
"I'll be 5 minutes," she called. "Do you know how to make coffee?"
When she came out, she was dressed in a sloppy cable-knit jersey that hung to her knees, and her hair was loose on her shoulders. He had never seen it like that, and he stared.
"This had better be good," she warned him, fists on her hips. "I've got Rowlands," he said,
and it was her turn to stare.
"Who or what is Rowlands?"
"The company that owns Zambezi Waters. I own it. It's mine. Zambezi Waters is mine. Is that good enough?" She started to come to him, her arms rising to embrace him, and he mirrored the movement, and instantly she caught herself and stopped, forcing him to do the same. They were 2 paces apart.
"Oh, that's marvellous news, Craig. I'm so happy for you.
How did it happen?"
"I thought it was all off.
Peter Fungerbearer arranged a surety for a loan of $5 million.
"My God, 5 million? You're borrowing 5 million? How much is the interest on 5 million?
He had not wanted to think about that. It showed on his face, and she was immediately contrite.
"I'm sorry. That was insolent. I'm truly happy for you. We must celebrate."
Quickly she moved away from him.
In the cabinet in the kitchenette, she found a bottle of Glenlivet whiskey, with an inch left in the bottom, and added it to the steaming coffee. "Here is success to Zambezi Waters," she saluted him with the mug. "Now first tell me all about it, and then I've got news for you also." Until after midnight he elaborated his plans for her. The development of the twin ranches in the south, the rebuilding of the homestead, and the restocking with blood cattle. But mostly he dwelt upon his plans for Zambezi Waters and its wildlife, knowing that this was where her interest would center. I was thinking I'd need a woman's touch in planning and laying out the camps. Not just any woman, but one with an artistic flair and a knowledge and love of the African bush. Craig, if that is meant to describe me, I'm on a grant from the World Wildlife Trust, and I owe them all my time. It wouldn't take up much time, he protested. Just a consultancy. You could fly up for a day whenever you could fit it in. He saw her weaken. And then, of course, once the camps were running, I'd want you to give a series of lectures and slideshows of your photographs for the guests. And he saw that he had touched the right key. Like any artist, she relished an opportunity to exhibit her work. "Now, I'm not making any promises," she told him sternly. But they both knew that she would do it, and Craig felt his new burden of responsibility lighten appreciably. "You said you had news for me," he reminded her at last, grateful for the chance to draw the evening out further. But he was not prepared for her sudden change to deadly seriousness. "Yeah, I've got news." She paused, seemed to gather herself, and then went on. "I have picked up the spoor of the master poacher." "My God! The bastard who wiped out those herds of Jumbo? That is real news. Where? How?" "You know that I have been up in the Eastern Highlands for the last 10 days. What I didn't tell you is that I'm running a leopard study in the mountains for the Wildlife Trust. I have people working for me in most of the leopardy areas of the forest. We are counting and mapping the territories of the cats, recording their litters and kills, trying to estimate the effect of the new human influx on them. All that sort of thing. Which brings me to one of my men. He is a marvellously smelly old Shangani poacher. He must be 80 years old, and his youngest wife is 17, and presented him with twins last week. He's a complete rogue, with a tremendous sense of humour, and a taste for Scotch whisky. 2 tots of Glenlivet, and he gets talkative. We were up in the Vumba Mountains, just the two of us in camp, and after the 2nd tot, he let it slip that he had been offered $200 a leopard skin. They would take as many as he could catch, and they would supply the steel spring traps. I gave him another tot, and learned that the offer had come from a very, very well-dressed young black driving a government Land Rover. My old Shangani told the man he was afraid that he'd be arrested and sent to jail, but he was assured that he would be safe, that he would be under the protection of one of the great chiefs in Harare, a comrade minister who had been a famous warrior in the Bush War and who still commanded his own private army. There was a hard cardboard folder on the camp bed. Sally Ann fetched it and placed it in Craig's lap. Craig opened it. The top sheet was a full list of the Zimbabwe cabinet. 26 names, each with the portfolio set out beside it. "We can narrow that down immediately. Very few of the cabinet did any actual fighting," Sally Ann pointed out. "Most of them spent the war in a suite at the Ritz in London or in a guest dacha on the Caspian Sea." She sat down on the cushion beside Craig, reached across and turned to the 2nd sheet. 6 names, she pointed. 6 field commanders. "Still too many," Craig murmured, and saw that Peter Fungabera's name headed the 6. "We can do better," Sally Ann agreed. "A private army? That must mean dissidents. The dissidents are all Matabele. Their leader would have to be of the same tribe." She turned to the 3rd sheet. On it was a single name. "One of the most successful field commanders, Matabele, Minister of Tourism, and the Wildlife Department comes under him. It's an old chestnut, but those set to guard a treasure are too often those who loot it. It all fits." Craig read the name aloud softly. Tungata Zibiwe, and found that he didn't want it to be true.
But he was with me in the game department. He was my ranger.
As I said, the keepers have more opportunity to despoil than any other.
But what would Sam do with the money?
The master poacher must be coining millions of dollars. Sam lives a very frugal life. Everybody knows that. No big house, no expensive cars, no gifts for women, nor privately owned land, no other expensive indulgences.
Except, perhaps, the most expensive of all, Sally Ann demurred quietly.
Power.
Craig's further protestation died unuttered, and she nodded.
Power. Don't you see it, Craig? Running a private army of dissidents takes money. Big, big money.
Slowly, the pattern was shaking itself into place. Craig admitted this. Henry Pickering had warned him of an approaching Soviet-backed coup. The Russians had supported the Matabele-Zipra faction during the war, so their candidate would almost certainly be Matabele. Still, Craig resisted it, clinging to his memories of the man who had been his friend, probably the finest friend of his entire lifetime. He remembered the essential decency of the man he had then known as Samson Kumalo, the mission-educated Christian of integrity and high principles, who had resigned with Craig from the game department when they suspected their immediate superior of being involved in a poaching ring. Was he now the master poacher himself? The man of fine compassion who had helped Craig, when he was crippled and broken, to take his single possession, his yacht, with him when he left Africa? Was he now the power-hungry plotter?
He was my friend, Craig said. He was, but he has changed. When you last saw him, he declared himself your enemy, Sally pointed out. You told me that yourself.
Craig nodded, and then suddenly remembered the search of his deposit box at the hotel by the police on high orders. Tungata must have suspected that Craig was an agent of the World Bank. He would have guessed that he had been detailed to gather information on poaching and power plotting. All that could have accounted for his unaccountably violent opposition to Craig's plans.
I hate it, Craig muttered. I hate the idea like hell, but I think that you just may be right.
I'm sure of it.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to Peter Fungabera with what evidence I have.
You'll smash Sam, Craig said, and she came back quickly. Tungata is evil, Craig, a despoiler.
He was my friend.
He was your friend, Sally Ann contradicted him.
You don't know what he has become.
You don't know what happened to him in the bush. War can change any human being. Power can change him even more radically.
Oh, God, I hate it.
Come with me to Peter Fungabera. Be there when I put the case against Tungata Zibiwe.
Sally Ann took his hand, a small gesture of comfort. Craig did not make the mistake of returning her grip.
I'm sorry, Craig. She squeezed his fingers. I truly, truly am, she said,
and then she took her hand away again.